Merchants.
Word versus Kaiser and others. Melissa W. Friedman, Appellant Counsel. Mark R. Herring, Attorney General. Toby J. Hyten, Solicitor General. Matthew R. McGuire, Principal Deputy Solicitor General. Victoria M. Pearson, Deputy Attorney General. Margaret H. O'Shea, Assistant Attorney General. Appellee Counsel.
You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May I reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal, please?
Well, if you've been in the audience watching...
Well, we'll just see how it turns out.
I'll do my best to help you out.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, I'm Melissa Friedman, and I'm honored to be here representing Mr. Carl Gordon. On his face, we submit this as a simple case. Mr. Gordon filed a complaint in Wise County Circuit Court and moved to proceed in forma pauperis. That motion was granted. And on September the 11th, the court filed a letter. I think I refer to it some in the briefs as an order, and I apologize for that. It appears to be an order, but in the appendix it says letter, stating that the case was scheduled for a hearing on motions on November the 1st. Justice Lee. On October the 10th, 2017, the defendants filed a demurrer and a request for sanctions. 13 days later, and 10 days before the scheduled hearing on motions, the plaintiff filed a motion for non-suit and a motion for extension of time to answer the demur. On November the 1st, 2017, the court ignored the plaintiff's motion for non-suit and granted defendant's demur and motion for sanctions. We submit that this was error by the trial court because the demur, although a dispositive motion, was not submitted to the court for decision under Virginia Code Section 8.01380 at the time the motion for non-suit was filed.
May I ask you this question?
Yes.
Suppose you're right that once, look, it wasn't submitted to the court for decision, non-suit should have been granted. But is there anything that would preclude the trial court from imposing sanctions if something truly is a frivolous complaint in the first place? And possibly under the statute saying you lose in forma pauperis because I have orders before me that show a bevy of frivolous claims. So I'm going to sequence this. I'm going to take up the sanctions. I'm going to look at this, whether you're still entitled to have in forma pauperis. And then at the back end, I'll grant you non-suit. What's wrong with that?
Well, Your Honor,
I mean, it's not what happened
that's
here.
That's
but,
not what happened.
But is there anything that would stop a court?
May have had the discretion, perhaps even under the statute, the requirement to determine whether or not this was a third strike, to deny informed pauperis and say you can't file the complaint unless you pay the fee. But I think it would have been incumbent upon the court to give the plaintiff that opportunity to come up with the fees, or perhaps in a different case somewhere down the line, at least give the litigant a chance to proceed not in forma pauperis.
Because I think the concern, which we see constantly, and I saw as a lawyer, are these, you know, inmates engaging in recreational litigation. It's not a trifling concern because you have to devote a lot of resources to swatting those down. And so, you know, I get that a non-suit's a non-suit, and so you're entitled to it as a matter of right. But we don't want a situation where you're able to perpetually elude sanctions or loss of informa pauperis by filing these frivolous cases.
Absolutely. That is a very legitimate concern, and I would like to address that. I just feel like that in this case, the judge and the attorney general went about it the wrong way. That certainly the court, the plaintiff had a right to get his non-suit. Okay? That doesn't mean that the court in a different case could not say that this is a strike and then this is a strike and this is a strike. It just so happens that in this case he could not get to that issue because legitimately the plaintiff had filed his motion for non-suit during a period of time when under the statute it was not within the rest of the court.
Well, the presupposition there is he has, and you've mentioned it twice, a right to a non-suit. What if the non-suit itself is simply one more stage of a pattern of abusive litigation? Doesn't the non-suit statute and all of its caveats presuppose that the actual non-suit is in good faith, too, and not in and of itself a violation of the good faith duty?
Well, you know, there's nothing in the statutes that say that. I mean, the exceptions to non-suit are very explicit, and this would not be one of them.
That's a fair point, but think through the obvious response, which is, okay, a demur. There's nothing in the demur law that says that you can put it off and ignore it if it's frivolous. That comes from the statute that says frivolous pleading should be stricken. Why is a non-suit request so sacrosanct that it can't be stricken, but every other document that's filed that's on its face part of a pattern of abusive litigation can be stricken, including a complaint, this complaint, which is on its face frivolous?
Justice Kelsey, I guess the way I would respond to that is moving for non-suit is not endless. You have one opportunity to file for non-suit.
One opportunity to file an abusive, frivolous non-suit to undo an abusive, frivolous complaint. That's the argument?
Well, Your Honor, I think that in the first place, I think, is a little strong. Let's call it frivolous.
Well, if you were paying the bills, you would find it abusive if you get sued by these kinds of actions.
I understand, Your Honor. I guess that the non-suit statute does, in fact, give every plaintiff the right to one non-suit. If a lawsuit is filed in bad faith, that's a different issue. But that's not what we have here. There was no finding here that it was made in bad faith or that it was made to harass. The finding was that it was frivolous and that it failed to state a claim, which is, I submit, different standard and a different, just a different standard.
Well, counsel, let me ask you this. You have, in response to the previous question, you said that if the request for revoking or prohibiting future form of papyrus applications as well as the pre-filing review were entered before the non-suit was, that would be all right. But what about our cases that we've handed down that say the trial court can consider motions for sanctions after the non-suit has been entered, as long as it was there at the time, as long as those requests were there at the time the non-suit was filed and it came within the 21-day window?
Well,
I'm speaking specifically of Williamsburg Peking Corporation.
I guess I have two responses to that, and I think that in this case there are two separate issues. I think one issue is whether or not the court should have granted the non-suit. And if he should have granted the non-suit, could he get to the sanctions?
Yes.
I think that this court could determine that the plaintiff had the right to a non-suit, but that the court still had the authority to reach the sanctions issue. And in reaching the sanctions issue, that wouldn't affect necessarily the litigant's, Mr. Gordon's right to bring the case again. It would affect his right to bring the case again in form of papyrus.
When you say sanctions, are you referring both to the pre-filing requirement and the informa pauperis determination made by the trial judge?
I am, Your Honor, but I think that they are two different things. I think that the informa pauperis argument is statutory under 8.01692, and only affects when a litigant can file informa pauperis. And I think that the trial judge here mixed the two up a little bit, because he made the determination that because the plaintiff had reached his three strikes under 692, that necessarily that triggers the pre-screening review. I don't think that that is necessarily the case. I think a pre-screening review is a much stiffer sanction that requires more. And I would direct the court to its decision in Atkins versus IPERS, Arlington Hotel. It's a 2017 case. I only have the Southeast citation, 799 Southeast 2nd, 929. And in that, it talks about due process and a litigant's right to access to the courts and the factors that have to be considered by the court before a pre-screening review can be applied. And those are things such as the party's history of litigation, in particular whether he has filed vexatious, harassing, or duplicative lawsuits, whether the party had a good faith basis for pursuing litigation or simply intended to harass, the extent of the burden on the courts and other parties, resulting from the party's filings and the adequacy of alternative sanctions. And this trial court did not address any of those factors. I suspect this court could do that if it wished, but the trial court did not. And I do think it's important to distinguish the difference between taking away someone's informal pauper status, which is pretty much automatic in some cases under the statute, and providing a pre-screening review to file a lawsuit at all.
Well, but that's not the only sanction. I mean, you could have hold someone in contempt and so on, right?
Certainly.
And that's a different analysis there.
Yes, yes, Your Honor, but that's not what's at issue here.
No, but we're looking, as the Chief alluded to in a prior case, this is what's in front of us.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a problem that radiates out in a number of fact patterns.
I understand. And that being the case, I would make this suggestion, if the court is inclined to sort of address the overall problem and sanctions, I think that it would be helpful for everyone if it were put into place, and perhaps this would have to be statutory, but for example, in the 06 case where the court said frivolous failure to state a claim, this is a strike under 692. And that didn't happen in any of the other cases that came before the courts with regard to Mr. Gordon until this last one. Perhaps there should be a suggestion that the trial courts, when they dismiss these cases, designate that it's a strike under 692. That puts the plaintiff on notice. If you file another one, then you're done. That's going to be your last one.
Well, counsel, can I ask you, though, going back to exactly what the court did with regard to the informer pauperous status of your client in this case? The order says that this court shall deny informer pauperous status to the plaintiff unless in the future claims he shows, et cetera, et cetera. Now, he had already granted informer pauperous status to the plaintiff. He did not, there's nothing in the record that shows that that status was revoked. So isn't the court saying, shall deny, that I'm going to deny it in the future?
Yes, Your Honor, I do think that's what the court is saying.
So he is not affecting his informa pauper status here.
No, exactly.
It's just for the future that he was denied.
Correct, correct. And I think I've pointed out in my brief that, you know, the fact that the appellee is saying that granting the non-suit was okay because the demurrer put the court on notice that it should that this plaintiff complaint is a nullity because he shouldn't have been allowed to file it in formal pauperous is really not a meritorious argument because that's not what happened here. And I think that the court has given the plaintiff sufficient notice here. If you file another one, you're not going to get in formal pauperous status. So I think
you're
in that
case, you're going to 2 minutes and 30 seconds. Why don't you answer Justice Lacey's question and
I'm
then
sorry.
You may. You're down to 2:25.
Oh,
answer
thank you,
Justice
Your Honor.
Lacey's question and then decide how you want to use the rest of your time.
Thank you, Judge.
You've answered my question.
Okay, thank you.
Good afternoon, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. Matt McGuire on behalf of the Warden. I'd like to take the case sort of in two parts based on the way the court's questions have come out this morning. The first is with respect to the motion to dismiss itself and the court's dismissal order, and then on the second being with respect to the sanctions imposed in this case. With respect to the dismissal order, I agree sort of with the tinge of Justice McCullough's questions that in an ordinary civil case, a plaintiff has a right to the non-suit. The simple filing of the demurrer in this case without sort of having a response and making it clear that both parties have yielded it to the court would be, the plaintiff would have had a right to a non-suit. Justice Kelsey's questions pick up on sort of the reason this case is different, and it involves sort of the Virginia Prison Litigation Reform Act, Code Section 801-692, the concerns that the General Assembly has with sort of abusive litigation by inmates that's frivolous or fails to state
and
a
the
claim.
Court's inherent power that predated 692, which 692 really only codified.
That's right, Justice Kelsey. And so you have this tension here, and I would submit that if you looked at the record in this case, the way the timeline plays out, the inmate files the complaint, the court looks at the inmate trust accounts that were submitted with it and the IFP status, which we know after Grethen versus Robinson, that's sufficient to allow him to file IFP on the face of what was before the court. The summons wasn't issued to the Commonwealth, and the Commonwealth wasn't on notice of this case until September, a couple of months after all that took place. And in the Commonwealth's first response to pleading, we put the court on notice that Mr. Gordon has filed an enormous number of lawsuits, a variety of which have been dismissed either as exactly as frivolous for one of the Wise County cases or in federal courts where he files a large number of claims, but the court ends up dismissing them for failure to state a claim at summary judgment.
In whole or in part,
Justice McCullough, but if you look at the opinions, for example, that were attached to the motion to amend the brief, the way that Judge Moon, I think, actually has both opinions, refers to it is that the allegations are insufficient. So even though you're at summary judgment, you could have come forward with evidence. They're just talking about bare allegations in the complaint.
But I don't think there's any question by the time you tally it up, you get to three, with this one being included.
I think that's certainly true, Justice McCullough. I think you get there without the three, which is sort of important on the non-suit side. So we think that the non-suit wasn't proper here, that the court didn't have to look at it given the unique nature of this case and could proceed to consider the dismiss.
I'm fine with, as Justice Kelsey was asking, that if the non-suit itself is frivolous and the court finds that, then I don't think you have to grant frivolous anything, whether it's a non-suit or anything else. But does the court have to make that finding?
Well, Your Honor, as you're aware, you can affirm on any basis in the record, and we, as we pointed out in our brief, think that the complaint filed here sort of stands on its face as being frivolous. So the ability to non-suit a complaint that is sort of facially frivolous, you know, I don't know how you would say that non-suit itself is frivolous. He gave reasons in his motion for why he would take a non-suit. But
therein is the very problem, because the non-suit would have to be intrinsically freestanding frivolous and an abuse. So if there was evidence that he repetitively does this, files these ridiculous cases against dental assistants or whatever, and then immediately non-suits it after he harasses the heck out of you guys, then it would be clear. But am I right, and Justice McCullough's question is going to it, is there was no finding here that the non-suit, qua non-suit, was frivolous?
No, Your Honor. There's no finding by the trial court on that specific basis, but we don't think it's necessary for a couple of reasons. The first, if you look at the recitation of cases in our brief, a variety of them have been voluntarily dismissed, often in federal court, often for a variety of different reasons. And so it's not uncommon for this litigant to take actions like that, so you can see it in the record, but the trial court didn't spell it out that way. I also would point out to the court that the trial court's in a little bit of a difficult position here. The complaint is docketed, the Commonwealth has moved to dismiss. I think 4 or 5 days later, the record shows Mr. Gordon filed a motion for a temporary injunction. Then he filed a motion for a non-suit, a motion for extension of time, a motion for a hearing, in addition to objections and a motion to compel related to the sanctions. And so as you're asking the court to decide when is it, quote-unquote, yielded to the court for decision, it is a little bit difficult to know. I think the worst fact on the record for us is the hearing, which, to Your Honor's point, was scheduled by the clerk of the court. If you look at it, it wasn't from the actual court itself. It came in 3 days after the court ordered the complaint docketed.
Yeah, that's not going to work. The clerk represents the court.
Right, Your Honor, but there ended up not being a hearing in this case, and as the court is aware, under 801-695, the only way there is going to be a hearing or even entitled to one as an inmate is if the court decides to hold one. So we don't see an issue with the court pulling back.
Why couldn't the Commonwealth simply say, grant the non-suit, and my very next thing is I want you to sanction him for the $80,000 we've spent of the taxpayers' money to fuss around with this nonsense and take his canteen money for the next 20 years?
Well, Your Honor, we haven't made that request, and I do think his inmate trust account shows that he is, in fact, going to be unable to file under the IFP status without meeting the exception, just given that I think he is sort of sitting at $0 in general. But to Your Honor's point, having recognized the non-suit issue under the court's current case law is challenging, we would point out to the court that under 801-692, once the court is aware that he has three strikes, the court is supposed to deny him IFP. And we have the argument on our brief that the right way to dismiss this case without bringing the non-suit would be to say, well, you have three strikes, your IFP status.
Well, counsel, let me ask you a little bit about the three strikes issue. You said that, in effect, all of these cases that you cited were dismissed because they were failure to state a claim. Now, I'm not real sure how we want to define failure to state a claim. It's had different definitions and Black's Law Dictionary, among everything else. But in some of the counts that Judge Moon recited in both of those cases, some were dismissed because the allegations failed to state a claim. Some were dismissed because there was inadequate proof to state a claim. Some were that the claim was meritless, understanding that. And some of them just said that it didn't rise to the level of in other words, the proof that was alleged didn't rise to the level. Now, is it your position that the failure to state a claim language in the statute is that the allegations were insufficient to state a claim? Or is it that there's a hearing or the burden of proof wasn't met to state a claim? Well, how do we define state a claim, failure to state a claim?
Well, Your Honor, it is failure to state a claim, and I do agree with you that Judge Moon's opinions do a lot, and it's because those lawsuits involve a sweeping number of claims, some of which were federal law RLUIPA claims, which essentially subjects the state to strict scrutiny that the inmate can show a substantial obstacle to their religious practice. Mm-hmm. Right? And it's common to not be able to get those cases dismissed at summary judgment. It's actually very easy to get past summary judgment in those cases. But I think the way Your Honor kept referring to Judge Moon's opinions is instructive here, which is he was referring to allegations. This is what the Fourth Circuit was talking about in Blakely when they were dealing with the summary judgment versus motions to dismiss. At summary judgment, oftentimes, even in prisoner cases, you will have them come forward with affidavits or declarations or other forms of evidence to justify why their lawsuit should be able to go forward. And it's not at all uncommon in the federal district courts, I think a couple of them have standing orders, sort of encouraging summary judgment instead of a motion to dismiss. So the posture doesn't tell you a lot. What I think is instructive is the use of the word allegation, which means that there weren't affidavits, there weren't declarations. It was simply the complaint itself, even though it was at summary judgment, didn't bear out the claim. Now, I think the hardest claim for us in those cases are the RLUIPA sort of related claims or the First Amendment claims, and that's simply because they're actually very favorable for a prisoner to bring. It's very difficult for the Commonwealth to get those claims dismissed this early. And so there requires more analysis from Judge Moon to explain why, under federal law, the claim fails. But the fact that that type of a claim failed at that stage is telling of itself for sort of the merits of it. And although he does oscillate between using allegations, or he says failure to state a claim in some instances, he says fails to establish a cause of action in others, we think what you should do is just look at the basis of the opinion, which dismisses the entire lawsuit in its entirety. And at least one of them also involved a motion to dismiss against somebody else that was dismissed in its entirety, to give the court a sense of how the case works. Another point I'd like to raise to the court is for the one that was deemed frivolous and as a strike under Virginia law. There's sort of two points about that. The first is in federal courts, and most courts that have addressed this, there is no requirement that courts spell out that they're issuing a strike. It's the court that's determining whether there are three strikes, looks at the relevant cases to determine if they count. So it's helpful to have a strike, but I heard my friend on the other side suggest this court impose a requirement that certain courts identify that. That may work as a matter of Virginia law, but federal courts, of course, wouldn't be required to comply with it, so you would have to determine how to handle that situation. The other point about that particular case, I think it's CL06568, he took three different appeals, I believe, of that case. And so in some federal courts, each iteration of the appeal counts as a separate strike. And the U.S. Supreme Court has sanctioned that approach and seems to have approved of it. So you have one case alone that may have qualified him under 801-692.
I ask you this sort of practical question. Do you have to get, in order to get this properly in front of the court, deciding the strike, whether the strikes are there, does it have to be certified copies or anything like that? I'm just practically speaking, trying to figure, because normally you think evidence has to come in front of the court a certain way. And I think there's a danger if you just have in your pleading a characterization, this is what the court did, and then you have these complicated opinions like Judge Moon go on page after page in meticulous detail analyzing the claim. So I'm just trying to figure out, practically speaking, what should judges be looking for, what do lawyers have to do?
So, Your Honor, in federal court, which is the best place that has the most case law on this, I'm not aware of any sort of evidentiary requirement to provide certified copies of opinions or prior orders. I think the common practice is the court is they're cited to the federal reporter or to the relevant Westlaw citation, and the court goes out and evaluates it.
But with circuit court opinions, unless somebody sends them to Professor Bryson, right, And then we have some cases that talk about, limitations on the ability to take judicial notice of even your own records, never mind what happened across the state.
I think that's a perfectly valid concern, Justice McCullough. I actually don't know how the circuit court here addressed it. It's not clear from his order. What is noteworthy is that the circuit court found that at least four of the cases that we cited...
This is a less hard case than you might have, where you're on just on the line of three, or maybe four or whatever, and then you're trying to figure out, and the court maybe doesn't in the order itself say, oh, frivolous, or fails to state a claim. And as you say, well, that may be the case without the court using the magic language. It's just a sort of, it doesn't go to the heart of this case, but it's just an overarching problem in this area.
In fairness, Justice McCullough, it could have come up in this case if we were putting in a certain amount of reliance on the mandamus action that is referenced in the amended opening brief about whether or not he actually filed that mandamus action in Wise County Circuit Court or with this court. So I can understand evidentiary questions around this, but I don't think they're really present here.
Well, counsel, could I ask you a question that I think does go to this case, and that has to do with the sanction action of pre-filing review. You didn't ask for that under 271. You just asked generally under, I guess, under the court's inherent power, which, of course, was recognized as adopted in our Atkins case. But as opposing counsel has mentioned, the Atkins case pretty much said if you're going to have that, you have to go through and analyze or at least consider the four Comer factors, which were not done in this case. So is that analysis so tied to a sanction based on inherent court procedure that it wouldn't require a different outcome as to the validity of that particular sanction?
I don't think so, Your Honor. I think two things. First, then the Atkins case was outside of the sort of inmate litigation context, so I would encourage sort of the inherent power of the court's sanction authority not to necessarily import the same rules there.
Well, wait a minute. Let me see if I understand you. Atkins was out of prisoner authority, but it is the one that talks about the sanction of pre-filing review. The statutory form of papyrus doesn't deal with that at all.
No, Your Honor, but what I'm pointing out is I think in Atkins, this court didn't borrow, like the trial court here did, the specific pre-filing screening for inmate litigation that you have in federal law. And so what the pre-filing review is required under Atkins is not what the trial court imposed here. So one of the arguments that my friend on the other side makes is that this fails because it's not limited enough, it's not concrete enough about what the sanction actually is. As a matter of federal law, which is cited in his order, or the court's order, is just, it's essentially a Rule 12b-6 motion to dismiss. The court just looks to see if the inmate has stated a claim at the outset before serving it on the Commonwealth, and if it's frivolous or not. And then they would enter a dismissal order without it coming to us. And that is the extent of that pre-filing sanction.
And so, but that's not what this court said.
Well, this court imposed a different set of requirements in Atkins. I don't remember them all immediately off the top of my head.
I'm sorry, by this court, I mean the order for the trial court here, not this court.
Well, the trial court order did, Your Honor. It says we're going to impose a pre-filing screening requirement consistent with 28 U.S.C. 1915A. And as we pointed out in our brief, that has very limited, straightforward requirements that just simply say the court, as a first instance, will determine if this case is frivolous before having it served on the Commonwealth. Just gives the court the ability to dismiss it outright without going through the motions with the Commonwealth. And so unless the court has...
Why would the trial court follow the federal procedure as opposed to the procedure we've set out in Atkins?
Your Honor, I'm not sure about the dates between the two opinions immediately, but the reason why I believe the circuit court here did it is, one, that's what our office asked for, and also just because it's familiar in the context of inmate litigation, generally speaking, where we see a lot of it at the federal level. So that would sort of be the basis for the request here.
Is that the type of dismissal that you referenced in your pleadings and before the trial court below?
The type in our sanctions pleadings before the trial court below, mm-hmm. Your Honor? Yes, and in terms of describing what we were asking the court to do, that's what we referenced. Unless the court has further questions.
Thank you. Rebuttal?
Just briefly, I want to reiterate that regardless what the court does with the sanctions issue, if the court feels that it can reach the sanctions questions through its inherent power, that's a different issue than whether or not the court appropriately ignored the plaintiff's motion for non-suit and whether or not that should have been granted.
Wouldn't we look at that through an issue of abuse of discretion? In other words, whether or not the trial court abused its discretion in not granting the time to be heard? Isn't that what you're talking about?
Well, Your Honor, with regard to whether or not it should have granted the plaintiff an extension of time to respond, it is an abuse of discretion standard because the court didn't address it at all or address any of the factors that it might in determining whether or not it was a good request. We would say that the court did abuse its discretion. With regard to the effect of the non-suit statute versus the informal pauperous statutes, we think that is a question de novo. And that in this situation, once the court had granted informal pauperous status, that had not been challenged by anyone, that the plaintiff did have a right to the non-suit. And that to rule otherwise could potentially in the future cripple the non-suit statute, because what would keep a litigant from saying that non-suit should not have been granted because the complaint failed to state a claim? And clearly, I think we would all agree that just because a complaint fails to state a claim, if that claim, that demur has not been submitted to the court for decision, that the plaintiff could have a right to a non-suit.
Ms. Freeman, the court thanks you and your firm for taking on this inmate's cause.
Thank you.
In this case before the court on a pro bono basis. Thank you very
much. You're welcome, Your Honor. Thank you.
The court will be in recess until 9 o'clock tomorrow morning.
All rise.